is Friday, August 17th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington. Coming up, a Turkish court rejects an appeal to release a detained U.S. pastor. Landmines prevent assistance from getting to civilians in Ghazni, Afghanistan. And the late singer Aretha Franklin talks to VOA in a 2008 interview. It's all ahead. A Turkish court dismissed an appeal Friday to release U.S. pastor Andrew Brunson, whose detention has triggered a diplomatic dispute between Turkey and the U.S. The High Court in the city of Izmir upheld a lower court's decision to keep Brunson under house arrest, according to Turkish media and Brunson's lawyer, Cem Halivert. The court also rejected an appeal to lift Brunson's travel ban. President Donald Trump commented on the strained U.S.-Turkey relations at the White House Friday.
Turkey's been a problem for a long time. They have not acted as a friend. We'll see what happens. They have a wonderful Christian pastor. He's a wonderful man, Pastor Brunson. They made up this phony charge that he's a spy, and he's not a spy. He's going through a trial right now, if you call it a trial. They should have given him back a long time ago. And Turkey has, in my opinion, acted very, very badly.
I asked reporter Dorian Jones in Istanbul whether the Turkish court that dismissed the appeal to release Brunson commented on the reasons for its decision.
No, the court didn't give any reason other than insisting that he should still remain under house arrest for the duration of the trial. He's currently facing espionage and spying charges. And if convicted, he will spend up to 35 years in jail.
This case has certainly strained relations between the United States and Turkey. What has the Turkish reaction been? Because I know President Trump, among other American officials, have been quite outspoken about this.
Well, indeed, this really is probably the worst crisis these two NATO allies have ever experienced, and they have had some difficult times in the past. What lays at the basis of this is there's a complete lack of trust between both sides. Now, Ankara insists that this is purely a matter for the judiciary. It says its judiciary is independent and it will respect, as it expects its allies to respect, the decisions and moves by the court. Now, Washington says this has nothing to do with legal matters. This case is a purely trumped-up charge that has no basis and basically are accusing Ankara of using Andrew Brunson as political leverage to extract concessions from Washington. In fact, the word political hostage-taking has been reused repeatedly by Congress people and members of the White House. So at the moment, there is this chasm of distrust, and it is further exacerbating already very difficult relations.
Now, apparently, U.S. Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin has said that the U.S. is ready to impose more sanctions on Turkey if Brunson is not released, but it doesn't sound like Turkey has any inclination to do that.
Yes, indeed. In fact, the very threat by Mr. Mnuchin of further sanctions saw the Turkish currency suffer quite a heavy fall. In fact, since this crisis erupted early this month with the White House introducing sanctions against two Turkish ministers over the ongoing detention of Andrew Brunson, the Turkish currency experienced very heavy falls, bringing the country to the verge of a full-blown economic crisis. Now, it has managed to pull back, at least for now, but the threat of further sanctions from Washington will raise the specter again that Turkey could be facing a major economic and financial crisis. There are heavy falls, as I said today, on the currency, and the expectation is if Washington does carry out major economic and financial sanctions against Turkey, then Turkey could be plunged into a further deepening economic crisis, which will have implications not only for Turkey, but also for Europe and possibly the international markets as well.
Reporter Dorian Jones in Istanbul. Here are some of the top news stories that are trending. President Trump expects to revoke security clearances of a Justice Department official. Pakistan's new parliament elects Imran Khan as the new prime minister. President Trump says the bank and fraud trial of his former aide Paul Manafort is very sad, and President Trump won't get his military parade until at least 2019. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on the voanews.com website. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
The chemical makeup of Earth's atmosphere is said to contain about 78% nitrogen and 21% oxygen, with argon, carbon dioxide, and other gases making up the remaining 1%. But in the atmosphere of what is considered to be the hottest, ultra-hot exoplanet found so far, scientists in Switzerland and Germany say they have found vapors of iron and titanium. The scientists say they were able to detect these heavy metals because of the incredibly hot surface temperature of the planet. Discovered last year, the exoplanet KELT-9b is said to have a dayside temperature of between 3,800 and 4,300 degrees Celsius. Scientists say the reason the exoplanet is so hot is because it orbits its host star, which is almost twice as hot as our sun, from a distance that's 30 times closer than the Earth's distance from the sun. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Sarah Williams. Coming up, the Asian Games begin Saturday, and we'll have a preview. The United Nations reports landmines and other explosive devices are making it too dangerous for aid agencies to enter the Afghan city of Ghazni. Civilians there are in need of food and water after nearly a week of intensive fighting. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
The Taliban, which attacked Ghazni August 11th, reportedly has moved to the outskirts of the city and is slowly withdrawing to surrounding villages. Afghan military forces are said to be engaged in mop-up operations in the center of the city of 270,000 people. According to the UN Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs, the Afghan Red Crescent reports 250 civilians have been killed during the week-long assault. OCHA spokesman Jens Laerke says aid agencies inside the city report conditions are desperate and civilians are living in a perilous state.
We expect that there will be a very big need for psychosocial support amongst the residents, including for children. There are reports of unaccompanied minors turning up at the hospital looking for their families. Many shops and markets have reportedly been burned or looted. Some shops have reopened, but the effect of this has been that prices for basic commodities have gone up.
Laerke says parts of the water system in Ghazni are functioning again, and mobile phone networks are gradually coming back. But he adds electricity is mostly out and must immediately be restored to ensure the water supply can start up again. He says civilians and humanitarian workers will not be able to enter the city until the mines and improvised explosive devices are cleared away. However, he says aid agencies already on the ground are doing their best to assist people. He says UNICEF aid workers are in the process of using chlorine to flush the water system. He adds the World Food Program is ready to deliver food aid from Kabul as soon as it is able to safely access Ghazni. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Even before the Asian Games officially begin Saturday in Indonesia, athletes made news. In a preliminary women's basketball game earlier this week, three North Koreans joined nine South Koreans to dominate Indonesia 108-40. The two Koreas will compete as combined teams in rowing, canoeing, and dragon boat racing. They joined forces during South Korea's Winter Olympics in February in Pyeongchang in women's hockey, albeit in a winless effort. But China is set to dominate again, as it has since joining the quadrennial competition in India in 1982. It took more than 400 medals, including 199 golds, at the Guangzhou competition in 2010. Brian Bridges is an adjunct professor at Hong Kong's Lingnan University and an East Asia sports analyst. He tells International Edition's Victor Beatty this is a significant athletic event for the Asia-Pacific region.
It's different from the Olympics in the sense that it has a much wider range of sports, although there will be a number of sports in the Indonesian Games where they are hoping to showcase them and that perhaps it could in turn become an Olympic sport at some later stage. So it is important in that sense also.
China has dominated these games for decades. Will it do so again, and by how much, do you think?
Well, I think it would be a great shock if China did not come top of the medal table again, yet again, which they've done consistently since the early 1980s when they rejoined the Asian Games. And I think although they may not be sending all their top stars, they certainly are sending some very, very good and very rising stars of various sports and athletics. So I would be very surprised if any other of the Asian nations would get anywhere close to the Chinese yet again in this Asian Games.
According to one report, some three-quarters of China's competitors have never been to an Olympics or Asian Games, and they're touting not only their ability, but their youth.
Yeah, I think that's part of it. I mean, there is Asian Youth Games, but those are for much younger athletes. This is a kind of stepping stone, right? For most of these athletes, if they do well in the Asian Games, then they've definitely got a chance, whether it's in the Chinese team or in other countries, of getting into Olympic events 2020 or even beyond that, 2024. So I think the athletes themselves will certainly take this very seriously, and it's quite important for them to really try hard.
One report suggests that Japan and South Korea could challenge China's supremacy, for instance, in table tennis.
Yes, there's going to be certain sports, right, where obviously Japan, South Korea, and in particular sports, maybe it's badminton and one or two others, you might find the Indonesians or the Malaysians challenging strongly. But I think in terms of overall coverage, China still is likely to have the strongest suit. Obviously, as host, Indonesia has tried to bring in some Southeast Asian sports in which Indonesia might have a comparative advantage. And I think Contract Bridge is featuring this time for the first time, and the Indonesians have obviously put that in because they think they have strong players, card players, let's say, in Contract Bridge. So there's a number of unusual sports in which Southeast Asians may challenge, but overall, probably outside of Japan and South Korea, the other states will only be able to challenge in one or two selected areas where they do have particular national strength.
India is a dominant country. It's rising country. Will it be showing well at the Games?
India is a little bit of a paradox in terms of its sporting abilities because, as you rightly say, it is a huge state in terms of population, size of economy, and definitely is one of the rising powers of the global system. And yet in sporting events, it quite often underperforms.
How will this pave the way for the 2020 Olympic Games in Tokyo?
I think it's another example of, you know, we're going through a phase now in which a succession of Olympic events are being held in East Asia. We've just had earlier this year, of course, the Winter Olympics in Pyeongchang in South Korea. We have the Tokyo Olympics coming up in 2020. And of course, then 2022, Beijing itself will be hosting the Winter Olympics. So these Asian Games are quite crucial in that sense of sort of providing the momentum, particularly in terms of athletes and coaches and so on, looking forward, of course, initially to 2020. So I think there is a very strong linkage between these two. And I think, you know, you mentioned earlier the Japanese. I think Japan wants to also set a good standard this time to show that, you know, when it comes to 2020, Japan is going to be competitive.
As for the Koreas, Brian Bridges said it's hoped the Korean athletic rapprochement, begun in South Korea and continuing at the Asian Games, will extend into the political world, leading to peace in Northeast Asia. This is VOA.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of Press Conference USA, VOA's Newsmaker interview program. Join us each Saturday and Sunday when we talk with authors, analysts, and policymakers who provide fresh insight on topics ranging from U.S. politics and foreign policy to science, culture, and global health. That's Press Conference USA, every Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.
Hey, sports fans, brighten your day by tuning into the Sunny Side of Sports Monday through Friday at 16:30 and 18:30 UTC. Join us on Facebook at facebook.com/VOA Sunny and on Twitter at VOA Sunny Sports. Or check out the blog at blogs.voanews.com/Sunny. It's the Sunny Side of Sports right here on the Voice of America.
This is International Edition. Mourners of Aretha Franklin gathered at a Detroit church where her father was once pastor and where she began singing as a youth. Throughout the evening Thursday, people strolled into the new Bethel Baptist Church to comfort one another and exchange memories of Franklin, who died of pancreatic cancer at the age of 76 on Thursday. Franklin was revered by fans as being the queen of soul for her strong gospel-inspired style of singing. To residents in her hometown of Detroit who followed her more than 50-year career, she was simply Aretha, or more personally, Ree. VOA's Larry London, who's also from Detroit, spent about an hour with Aretha Franklin 10 years ago, and we have a snippet of their conversation. Here's Larry London.
Well, one of the most wonderful moments that I have in my life was watching you in 1998 on the Grammys, as far as music goes, to see you come on stage and at the last minute, I understand, fill in for Pavarotti, who was very ill. And I still, and I'm not kidding when I say this, I have in my iPod Nessun Dorme that you sang. Yes.
Wonderful.
And I listen every morning while I'm exercising to you. To you.
Really?
That inspires me.
Okay.
And that was, you inspired so many, and everybody gave you a standing ovation, and that was wonderful how you hit all the notes.
It was a wonderful night. What a night. With two standing ovations that night. What a night. I'll always remember that.
Well, you probably also have more standing ovations than anybody else in the industry, I'm sure, as well.
I wouldn't say that, but I've had a few.
And recently you were honored by the NAACP with a Vanguard honor.
Yes, that's true.
The honors just keep coming in for you.
Wonderful. Mr. Julian Bond, a longtime civil rights man, wonderful man.
Now, I was asked to, you know, one of our listeners, when I mentioned that you were going to be on, they wanted to know, because they're also from, like we are, from Detroit. And they said that there's a councilwoman there, Martha Reeves, who was in the music business. And she's now behind some proposal for artists to be paid for their music to be played on the radio. And that's a very big issue right now.
Artists do get paid for their music being played on the radio.
Okay.
You get mechanical rights.
Right, as composers and authors.
Yes.
But as performers,
okay.
A lot of the
artists.
Now
that I was not aware of. Okay.
So I didn't know if you knew that bill.
Okay, as a performer, no, I wasn't aware of that. That must be kind of, it's recent, right?
Yes, yes, okay. In the last year or two.
Okay.
And I know that Martha Reeves is behind that from Detroit, so I thought since we're both from Detroit, that I'd ask if you were involved in that.
I missed that one.
You missed that one. The album duets, you know, with the Queen that you put out last year, you worked with so many tremendously talented people from music today, a fabulous collection. How do you pick who you're going to perform with, who you're going to record with? Over the years, you've done George Michael and Elton John, and the list goes on. How do you pick these artists to collaborate with?
Well, a lot of times, Clive would bring things to me. Sometimes the artist themselves will call, or it's someone that I would like to record with. So it can happen either one of those ways.
Is there anybody that you haven't worked with yet that you would still like to?
I would love to do something with Smokey, and love to do something with Stevie. And I very much wanted to do something with Oscar Peterson, but unfortunately he passed. God bless. And I'd love to do something with Herbie Hancock. And I have a favorite gentleman on the sax. His name escapes me right now, but he is so good. He is so good. Herbie knows who he is.
Well, there's tremendously talented sax players. You know, Gerald Albright is one.
Yeah, Gerald Albright is terrific.
Yeah, there's
He's
a lot
very
of
good.
Now, of all the people you've worked with, do you have a favorite time or moment or song? It's hard to pick, probably.
It's, yeah.
So many babies.
There have been so many. It's hard. It would be hard to say.
Now, talking about babies, you have a couple of children who are music-oriented, musically-oriented. Teddy, I went to school with.
Right.
Who performs in your band.
Talking about that. Right. Oak Park High.
Right.
Okay. And my other son, Kelf, is a producer on an album that's forthcoming out in the spring of 09. Aretha, A Woman Falling Out of Love. And Kelf did something on that album. Eddie is singing, and he travels with me, my other son, Eddie. He's a writer, and they are up until midnight and in the wee hours of the morning making tracks, and he and his musical partner. So yeah, everybody's in the game.
And you got your sons on the Christmas album.
Yes, and Eddie is also singing, that's right, this Christmas with me.
That's
on
great.
The Christmas album, along with Silent Night and 14 Angels, something that I learned as a child that has stayed with me all of these years from the opera Hansel and Gretel. And there's so many good things on there. You just have to hear it.
Now, how do you pick the songs for a Christmas album? I mean, your career is four decades long, and now you decide, I'm going to do a Christmas album, and there's so many great Christmas songs.
Mm-hmm.
It must have been a difficult...
Well, I had to do the traditional things, like Silent Night and Angels We Have Heard on High. That's my favorite. That is my favorite. And Ave Maria is on there. What is the other one? Hark the Herald Angels Sing. That's another one of my favorites. Those two I particularly just love. And the one with Eddie, my son, This Christmas. And Christmas Just Ain't Christmas Without the One You Love. The OJs, that was so terrific. That's every Christmas, that's the first record that's played in the house.
Wow.
Yeah.
What are you going to be doing this Christmas? What will happen in, besides listening to the OJs?
This Christmas, I'm going to play mine first and then play theirs, probably.
Now, you
ladies
know.
Ladies before gentlemen.
That's right. Always ladies first.
Yeah.
And the queen first.
VOA's Border Crossings host Larry London speaking with Aretha Franklin back in 2008. That's our show. Please visit our website at voanews.com. I'm Sarah Williams. Thanks so much for joining us. Have a great weekend.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
As promised, President Donald Trump has reimposed a series of U.S. nuclear-related sanctions on Iran that had been lifted under the nuclear deal, known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action. After the U.S. ceased its participation in the deal in May and a wind-down period of 90 days ended, sanctions went into effect August 7th, targeting, among other things, Iran's purchase or acquisition of U.S. banknotes, its automotive industry, and transactions related to Iran's currency, the rial. All remaining U.S. nuclear-related sanctions, including those targeting Iran's energy sector and transactions by foreign financial institutions with the Central Bank of Iran, will be reimposed on November 5, 2018. In a written statement, President Trump said the United States is fully committed to enforcing all of our sanctions, and we will work closely with nations conducting business with Iran to ensure complete compliance. Individuals or entities that fail to wind down activities with Iran risk severe consequences. President Trump welcomed the decisions by many international firms to leave the Iranian market and noted that several countries have indicated they will end the imports of Iranian oil. We urge all nations, he said, to take such steps to make clear that the Iranian regime faces a choice: either change its threatening, destabilizing behavior and reintegrate with the global economy, or continue down a path of economic isolation. U.S. officials have noted that the revenue Iran received because of sanctions relief under the nuclear deal was used to spread terrorism and instability from Syria to Yemen to Gaza and beyond, instead of being used to improve the lives of the Iranian people. In his statement, President Trump emphasized that while the United States continues to apply maximum economic pressure on the Iranian regime so that it changes its destructive policies, he remains open to reaching a more comprehensive deal that addresses the full range of the regime's malign activities, including its ballistic missile program and its support for terrorism. In addition, President Trump stressed continued support for the Iranian people, who are the rightful heirs to Iran's rich heritage and the real victims of the regime's policies. "We look forward to the day," he said, "when the people of Iran and all people across the region can prosper together in safety and peace."
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.